Blog Talk Radio. This is the September 6, 2017 edition of Don't Let It Go Unheard, and this is where we discuss news, politics, and culture from the perspective of the ideas behind American exceptionalism. I'm your host, Amy Peekoff, and hello to everyone who's joining me live over in the Blog Talk Radio chat room. Robert writes, hooray! I am here, and this is the beginning of the new schedule, so with a minor exception of a holiday here or there, I'm going to be here 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and the show's going to be usual time that we've had on Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific, so you're going to be hearing from me this week, both today and Friday. I took off the Labor Day holiday. I hope you guys did okay during that holiday as well. If you zoom over to the blog at don'tletitgo.com, you will see the title of today's show, Who's Appealing to Emotion in the Debate over DACA and Immigration More Generally. And the title comes out of a debate that I was engaged in on Twitter the other day, and you can see the little snippet. I've put it in the program notes, the particular tweet that I was responding to. Actually, as I see it on the blog embedded, you don't see the tweet that I'm responding to. Guy's basically accusing me of appealing to emotion. And let me tell you what was going on in the debate. I have been thinking about immigration policy and discussing immigration policy in the following way. And this is when I've been tweeting to President Trump or just tweeting in general about immigration. And it's this, right? If government is going to act in any realm, and I think this should include immigration policy, it has to act on the principle of individual rights, right? You know, a government, if it's going to be moral, if we're going to have government at all, it's got to be limited by that principle. And so if you're going to have government act on immigration policy, it's got to act with reference to that principle, okay? And, I mean, this is the way that I've been thinking about it. So, for example, if you think you want to keep people out so that you can protect American jobs, you can put hardworking Americans first is the way that Donald Trump's been talking about it. If you're doing that, if you're doing it for economic reasons, you are not protecting the rights of Americans. What you're doing, you think you're furthering their interests, so to speak, right? But if you actually dive in and think about these things, is it really in your interest to have government use force to protect you from competition from other people in any realm? And I think if you think about it enough, you know, government's pointing guns at people to make sure that you don't have to compete in the workplace. No, probably not. It's probably not even, you might think it is. A lot of people think it is. There's a lot of people on Twitter who think it is. But it's not protecting your rights, that's for sure. What would be, in my view, you know, consistent with protecting your rights is having a check at the border where the criteria for keeping people out would be limited to those things that pose a physical threat to Americans. Because how are your rights violated? Your rights are violated by the initiation of force from people. So, for example, are the people who are coming over people who have criminal records of some kind? Are they, well, not just some kind, of a violent kind, right? some kind of minor traffic infraction that turns out to be a criminal offense wherever they're coming from, you know, not this kind of stuff. So, you know, and we could have discussions about what the criteria should be within this principle, right? You and I could have vigorous debates, hopefully over a beer or a glass of wine or something, right? But have a vigorous debate over how exactly you're going to apply this. But the principle would be, are these people criminals who pose a risk of physical harm to Americans? Are they enemies? You know, maybe there's a current war that's going on and you've got people wanting to come here from either someplace in the Middle East or North Korea or China, if we end up in scuffles with them, Russia. You know, if we have a war going on and you've got somebody who's trying to cross the border as part of an enemy that is actively engaged in an attempt to destroy or undermine the United States, no, we're keeping these people out. And then you and I could have, again, this vigorous discussion over beer, wine, whatever, about who falls into that category. So there's that. And then, of course, there's this issue of dangerous and highly contagious diseases, something like Ebola. You know, you're not going to let people just come in while they're about to, you know, give everybody in their path Ebola. So those would be the criteria. Some people would say, okay, well, if you're applying individual rights, the principle of individual rights, why don't you treat people who are coming in the same as people here, right? And Rand, you know, Ayn Rand, whose philosophy I believe is correct, when she talks about politics, she talks about government acting only in retaliation, not, for instance, regulating in advance of knowing that somebody is violating rights or that, you know, in advance of a rights violation. So we wouldn't, for instance, tell Silicon Valley how it can do business. But if Silicon Valley, people in Silicon Valley, this is a story we're going to talk about later. If people in Silicon Valley commit some sort of fraud or violate the rights of customers or employees or whoever, then you have legal redress in the courts and you can sue. But you shouldn't in advance regulate, tell employers how they should do their job. You let them go ahead and do their job and do everything through voluntary transactions with other people and only step in if you're government when there's a rights violation. Not regulation. What you want to do is you want to redress if there's been a violation of rights. That's what you do with a proper moral government. So some people would say, okay, well, why even stop people at the border at all? Why not just have completely open immigration, no borders, right? But I say no for a couple reasons. One is the people who are already inside your country are different from people outside in that they have been living and operating, existing within the jurisdiction of the United States and are known to authorities. And one thing that we know is that there's kind of a normal amount of either potentially criminals wanting to come in without you knowing that they've got this record. And there's also pretty much always ongoing skirmishes around the world. And, you know, again, the potential for these dangerous, contagious diseases, we don't know the status of people. So some sort of check at the border, you know, this is the place, you know, again, what does the government have? Government has a monopoly on the legal use of retaliatory force within a particular geographic area. So the border means something. The border means that the government theoretically has a handle on what's going on and, you know, an idea of the track record of all the people who are inside. They don't know what's coming over the border. So I think there is an objective reason tied to rights, tied to the nature of government, to stopping people. But if you're going to stop them and then you're going to actually not let them come in, the reason that you are not going to let them come in, I think, has to do with rights, not with, oh, they have some ideas in their head that, you know, or they have a culture that you think is not wholesome or whatever. It's got to be something that they pose a real present danger of violating the rights of American citizens. That's my criteria. So this is what I was discussing, right? And if you want to hear more on immigration policy and the whole debate, because there are other people who say, yes, they also agree with objectivism, but they think I'm all wrong, I'm all washed up on immigration policy. If you want to hear a full discussion of all those issues that I had with Yaron Brook I put a link to the discussion that I had with him in February in the program notes. And in that, I attempted to raise a bunch of different issues that have been brought up by challengers. We'll talk about some of it today, but today I want to focus more on this issue of, am I appealing to emotions when I say that we should limit government to acting on the principle of individual rights, even in immigration policy? Am I doing this? Because that's what I was accused of. I had this discussion with somebody who goes by the name of Gregory Adams on Twitter, and he says, oh yeah, you're just appealing to emotion. The entire discussion that I had with him was focused on limiting government's action in this realm to the principle of individual rights. That's all it was. I wasn't saying, oh, what about the poor people? I mean, I did say that people were innocent. Maybe at one point I said somebody was innocent, but I didn't talk about their suffering or any, it would just, this, as far as I know, came out of the blue. So am I appealing to emotion? I'm appealing to this principle. Another thing that I've been accused of, and we could talk about that, and you can call in and discuss this with me if you want as well, is somehow I'm dropping context, that I shouldn't be applying the principle of individual rights the way that I'm applying it in this particular context with respect to immigration. I'm failing to recognize some salient aspect about the context. If you want to tell me where I'm dropping context, what part of the context you think I am leaving out, then go ahead and call in. The number is 760-888-5817. Again, that's 760-888-5817. Of course, you can just call in and share your experiences debating this issue. But that's really the question. Am I appealing to emotion? If I am, or if you think I'm appealing to emotion, what might be the thought behind it? And I can only talk to you about this long discussion. I went in circles and circles. If you want to go and follow my Twitter feed and see that how the discussion went with this guy, you can check it out. But I went in the circle about five times or so, and then I said, okay, I'm done. And the place that we kept bumping up against was that I would talk about the law, our immigration law, as being unjust. Our immigration law is unjust because it's not currently based solely on the principle of individual rights. DACA was this attempt to put a Band-Aid, kind of on our faulty immigration policy and let some potentially productive people stay here and work, et cetera. But, basically our immigration law is unjust. Now, what this person was saying is, hey, law is law. He was essentially asserting what in legal philosophy we call the positivist position. The law that we have that's on the books right now, the immigration law that we have on the books, followed the proper procedure. You know, it was passed and, you know, Congress, the majorities that were required in both the House and the Senate, and then it went to the president and he signed it, and it's the law of the land, and we need to have the rule of law in this country. And so somehow I'm against the rule of law and therefore I'm bad. And I kept asking this person, and this is where I got, back to the beginning of the circle again. You can see this tweet where I was reacting to him. And Twitter's, talk about having to put your thought in the tiniest bit of essential phrasing. Again, I go back with this person. I say, do you think that every law on the books today is just? I don't care who it is that you talk to walking down the street, liberal, conservative, libertarian, whatever, there's going to be some law on the books that they disagree with and that they would be sympathetic with attempts to change. You would be sympathetic with people who, either disobey the law just out of necessity to live their lives, or they do it consciously because they're trying to mount opposition to the law. Talk about a Martin Luther King Jr. doing that. So certainly this person never answered this question, by the way. Do you think that every law on the books today is just? It was interesting because I had one other person who was joining the discussion and said, by the way, they had a bunch of law in Nazi Germany, a lot of which was unjust. And there's one law that they talk about in philosophy of law textbooks in particular. It was really bad, which is that it was perfectly okay in Nazi Germany to reveal private discussions, you know, like with a spouse or something, that you reveal it to the authorities, and then that person gets put basically in the front lines up for slaughter in the war as a result of saying bad things about Hitler or whatever, treason. Whereas normally you wouldn't be allowed to, for, you know, for instance, reveal these things knowing that the person's going to be sent to their death. That's the sort of law that was on the books and that they were trying to untangle and deal with after the fall of the Nazi regime. You know, do they, for instance, prosecute a woman like this for, you know, reporting her husband or something? So this is the kind of law that was on the books. It was considered perfectly legal during the Nazi regime. And then afterwards, of course, we look at this, we know this is horribly unjust. You know, report your husband. Maybe he didn't even say anything. You might have lied about it to the authorities, knowing he's going to be sent to his death on the front lines. So when we brought this up to this person, actually, I didn't bring it up. This other person brought it up. What did he do? He didn't even address it. Like, oh, yes, law can be unjust. Just block the person. So didn't deal with it at all. And the way you can see this is that this person, this Gregory Adams, is treating anything that's in law as some sort of fact that you're just resigned to accept in the world. And this is how the positivists treat it. You know, they say law is law. And, you know, there's one thing to say what the law is, and then there's another thing to evaluate the law. We have to keep that separate. What some people do is they take it a step further, is they say, okay, well, we shouldn't even really worry about evaluating the law. And we certainly shouldn't follow Thomas Aquinas, who said an unjust law is no law at all, and decide that maybe in some cases, at least, that we have a right to, and that we should break the law when it is unjust, right? And there's all kinds of permutations along that route that you can take. You know, do you have a duty to violate an unjust law? Is it just that you can? Should you in certain cases or not? You know, there's that discussion. But if it's an unjust law, that certainly puts it in a different category in my mind than if it's, you know, a just law. And that was the bumping up there. Now, so then the question is, how am I appealing to emotion? According to this guy, he never gave an explanation. I said, appealing to our founding principle, individual rights, is not appealing to emotion. But how could you say that maybe it is? And the only thing I could think of is, again, when I'm drawing upon my background in philosophy of law, which I've taught many times over the years, when you think of the positivists, the people who say, well, law is law, and you just, you know, accept the law and you apply the law and that's it. If the law, you know, if we have immigration law, DACA is this unconstitutional attempt to get around immigration law, and so therefore it's bad, it's violating the rule of law, you know, rule of law is supreme. Positivists think that, for instance, if I talk about rights, if I talk about what a person should be free in, you know, according to morality or political theory to do, if I'm talking about rights, I'm not speaking in an objective way. I'm speaking in a way that's based only on emotion, that, you know, suddenly we're in the realm of the woozy. There's no objective truth in what I'm talking about. And so therefore, all I could be doing is appealing to emotion. And in the history of philosophy, there was this period in the early 1900s, and I think A.J. Ayer was one of these who, what they call emotivists. And they said that if you are engaging in moral evaluation of somebody, if you're evaluating somebody morally, all you're really doing, I mean, you might think in your mind that you're making arguments based on logic and premises and all this kind of stuff, but all you're really doing is the equivalent of saying boo about the bad, that you just disapprove of the bad, and yay about the good. And it's just an emotion. Boo, yay, ethics is the way we used to joke about it. And it seems like a very natural leap from believing that ethics is about nothing more than just emotions expressing approval and disapproval with no logic at all behind it, to saying, okay, in law, I'm going to base my theory of law on positivism, on the idea that for law to be law, it doesn't have to have a litmus test based on whether it's just, whether it protects rights or any of these other things, right? That's all this natural law theory based on woozy ethics. Instead, what we're going to have, according to the positivist, is we're going to have law upheld and, you know, that you have a duty to obey based on pedigree, proper pedigree. And that's the sort of argument that this guy kept putting in front of me in Twitter, is that, you know, we have immigration law on the books and it's based on, you know, law that was passed through the House and the Senate and signed by the president. And DACA is just supposedly this unconstitutional order by, you know, a president who's no longer even in office, an attempt to get around the so-called rule of law. The DACA doesn't have the proper pedigree for these people. So the question is, am I only appealing to emotion if I appeal to this principle of individual rights? And if I insist on evaluating the law and also, you know, urging for immigration reform along these lines of this principle and everything, I would of course say no. But this is where you realize that you're having these discussions on Twitter and you cannot get away from fundamental philosophical issues. And in fact, during this show, I'm going to actually pull a little bit of a bait and switch on you, just like our President Trump actually did on his supporters. We'll talk about that. But I would say that the issues that come up, and I'm drawing on a friend of mine, and I'll give credit in a minute, but the issues that come up are even more fundamental. They have to do with a distinction in philosophy called the metaphysical versus the man-made. I wasn't going to put that in the title because I'd scare everybody off. So, but stick with me because I'm going to explain what I mean and how these issues come up. And this issue of what's called the metaphysically given, what's just given in reality versus the man-made, and confusions about these kind of permeates the discussion in both, I think, this immigration policy discussion, people's reaction to it, and then kind of in a humorous and sad way, Donald Trump's discussions of the hurricanes and stuff like that. I'm going to tie it to that as well. So that's kind of a mouthful. We've got a few people on the line here. Remember that if you do want to talk to me when you're calling in, you're going to have to press the one button to let me know that you're on the line to do more than just listen to the show. Again, this number is 760-888-5817. So let's talk for a few minutes about how you might say I'm appealing to emotion when I'm talking about this principle of individual rights, and why I think that I'm not just appealing to emotion, why I think there's something solid to it. Some people would say, okay, well, how is it that you bridge the gap between whatever we see that is in the world and in reality versus the ought, what people ought to do, how government ought to behave, what the law ought to be? How can you get from there, from what is? And like I said, there's a number of people in history of philosophy who say you just can't bridge that gap. And in fact, all of our ought statements out there that, you know, you ought to behave a certain way, government ought to behave a certain way, you ought to treat other people a certain way, ought to do this, ought to do that, you should do this, you should do that. All of it's just based on sheer emotion. That's what these people would say. It's not based on reality at all. And so that's a gap that people have to bridge. Is there anything more than emotion between the nature of reality and how you ought to behave, how things ought to be, how government ought to react? This Gregory Adams guy obviously thinks no, because the whole time that I was asserting our founding principle of individual rights, he was saying all I'm doing is appealing to emotion. And I would say no, that there is something there. I don't know that I'm going to give you the full defense of rights being based in reality here today, but I'm going to sketch it for you a bit. And I'm going to urge you that there's a couple essays that you can look at from the philosopher Ayn Rand that can help you bridge it. There's one essay called The Objectivist Ethics, and it's available free online. The Ayn Rand Institute, I believe, just publishes the whole thing out there and you can see it. Rand published it in the 60s. She actually delivered it at University of Wisconsin to a group there. I had a philosophy professor at USC when I was doing my degree there who was there when Rand had delivered this. So that was kind of a cool thing. In that essay, Rand talks from the very foundation and says, hey, you know, when we start talking about ethics, we have to talk about why do we even need ethics at all? What is the foundation of ethics? What does it mean to value something? And she says, look, you can look at certain facts about reality. Who or what is it? What is it that can value? What is a value at all? And, you know, she can say, okay, well, value, if it's anything, is something that you act to gain or keep. Who is it that values or what is it that values? Only living things. And she roots the whole realm of values, the whole idea of ethics, in a fundamental alternative of life and death, which confronts only human beings. And, you know, again, then to sketch it out, this is how you get, and you know, how you're going to bridge the is to the ought, right? We have living things pursuing values. They engage in self-sustaining action based on this pursuit of values. They pursue the values in order to live. And so as human beings, what do? Of course, we have to engage in this self-sustaining behavior as well. Otherwise, we're going to die. We can either engage in this kind of value pursuit in accordance with our natures. We can pursue the values that we'll pursue, you know, that will sustain our lives. And we can pursue them in such a way that it is consonant with our nature, with our means of survival, or we can try to do it in some other way. And what Rand says is, look, if you're going to, as a human being, try to live, try to pursue the values that sustain human life, then you need to engage in the type of activity that's consistent with your nature. So it's human nature. You're deciding that you want to live as the kind of thing that you are. You are a human being. And therefore, if you're going to pursue the values that sustain your life, you have to choose them appropriately, right? You can't just go out and start doing meth and hope that you're going to live a long, wonderful life. And then also you need to gain those values in accordance with your nature. What is it about you that enables you to pursue values as a human being? Hint, it's not our brute strength, it's our mind. And so Rand says, yes, we need to be able to act according to our own judgment, use our rational faculty in order to live. And it's that necessity that gives rise to the principle of rights. We need to be left free to act on our own judgment, engage with trade with others, acting on their own judgment, and produce the values that sustain our life. Anything that you look at the grocery store or anywhere else, you need to see, you know, you kind of recognize if you go through the exercise that the blueberries got there at the grocery store because of a whole bunch of people using their rational faculty to make it the case that fresh blueberries arrive at the grocery store that you're able to buy and purchase. So briefly, yes, there is this way. I've just kind of sketched it in a decent but kind of haphazard way. You can read this essay by Rand called The Objectivist Ethics if you want more. So I want to say I'm not appealing to emotion. I know, and I just sketched it out for you, that there is this basis for rights in reality. It's not just based on emotion. I feel some days that I would want things to be a different way. I really don't, not about politics. You might say, well, I feel, no. My discussion about rights does not have anything to do with emotion. Now, I may have some strong emotions around rights. I may, you know, be very outraged if people's rights are violated. I might be fearful if a president is, you know, showing an intention to engage in mass violations of rights. There's different emotions I could experience around rights, but if I'm engaging in this argument, I'm not appealing to the emotion. So yeah, I have emotions about the issue. Am I appealing to those in the argument? No, I don't think so. And again, I've got this, you know, this argument behind it to back me up. I've got someone who is on the line and has pressed the one. So I'm going to go ahead and try and take a call here. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
Hi, this is Joe. I'm calling from suburbs outside Chicago. Thanks for having me on.
Okay, great. Thanks for calling, Joe. First time caller, right?
Yes, I am. I've listened to a few episodes by in bits and had enough time to call in. I hope you're not getting any background noise. I'm in a kind of a loud room.
I'm getting a little bit, but not too bad, and it's not feedback, so that's good.
Okay, good to hear. Your main question, I wanted to track it, although you sketched out more background since your main question. Was this gentleman's claim that you were appealing to emotion have anything in it? And can I ask you, were you under the impression that this guy was kind of on the left side of politics or on the right side?
He's definitely more on the right side, like a Trump supporter, because on this issue, I happen to be aligned with a lot of people on the left because I think we should have more open immigration.
Okay, so I had kind of two potential answers ready. If he was a leftist, I would have said that he's been called on appealing to emotion many times, so he'd probably try to just turn that around and throw that at you and see if it stuck.
Sure.
And then I was thinking if he was on the right side, right leaning, when if you use the word unjust, people that don't have as thorough an application of what unjust means to them as you do, or most of the people that follow objectivism have, unjust means unfair to them. And unfair to whom? Unfair in this case to the dreamers. So you are referring to a policy that this person feels is unfair to the dreamers. That's kind of what I got out of it. Now, if you were to say, or if he were to ask you, well, what do you mean by unjust? Well, then you could totally pull out and tease out all the context that contributes to you claiming something is unjust. Well, he's a patriotic American, most likely, so all the checks and balances for him that make something a law is law for him. So
Right. If
something has become law, if he believes in the American system so thoroughly, everything that's become law here has to have gone through the proper checks and balances to have become law for him. So you're calling into question the mechanism that makes something become law in this country. Therefore, you're unpatriotic. The objectivist side of things might say, well, no, I'm not a nationalist, but that's a different term than patriotic, because patriotic holds in it flattery, you know?
Right.
So I would say, if you were to ask him, I don't know if you did, if you were to ask him, what do you mean by unjust? That's about where, no offense to him, that's probably where his intellectual ceiling was, and he probably wouldn't know what to say, or maybe he would say.
The way the discussion went, though, Joe, is that he never even delved into what would be just or unjust. That was irrelevant to him in this discussion, because I was the one who was invoking the issue of justice. He was saying that I was appealing to an emotion simply by my invocation of justice or rights or things like that.
Mm-hmm. So according to him, maybe, I mean, we're speaking for another person here, but
sure.
if somebody claims something in the legal system that has passed into law, or at least being enforced by legal authorities, or unenforced, if that's the legal standard, then any question of it is appealing to the supposed victims of this legal standard, appealing to the livelihood. Probably when you said, that's unjust. You know, he flashed on he was watching, you know, a news network earlier that day, and he saw people crossing the river, and he's like, oh, you know, that's totally unjust to
this discussion. There's two different things, right? So if I say it's unjust, I mean that the current immigration law, apart from DACA, that it violates the rights of these people and also the employers who want to hire them and the people who want to rent them apartments and everything else, right? So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm talking about a rights violation issue. And, yeah, there is suffering that goes along with rights violations, but I'm not appealing to the suffering. I'm not trying to get people sympathetic, you know, and I'm not trying to tug on their heartstrings about the suffering. You know, I'm talking about actual rights violations that I can reduce, and I can point to reality and say, look, there's an initiation of force right there, you know. And to these people, it's like if it's on the law, and I don't even know if he really believes that about everything, because he never answered that question. I asked a couple different times. I said, mm-hmm. Hey, isn't there some law in the book that you think is unjust? Never would answer it. And I think that they just like to hide behind procedure with respect to this issue, because they don't want to tell you why they want the law to be the way it is. They don't want to get involved in the moral discussion about immigration policy. They just want to say, well, law is law, and, you know, we have to uphold the law, right?
Yeah. I think, you know, I don't know whether this gentleman was including benefits that people get when they enter into the country illegally in his
sure.
kind of mindset, and then didn't take the time or wasn't able to list them out in front of other people, because, you know, if there's a law that, you know, benefits one side or the other, there's one group that benefits from the way things are now, and there's
right.
the one group that doesn't benefit from the way things are now according to a law. If we want to, say, change the law, then we're arguing for the benefits of one of the sides and against
yeah.
the
yeah.
freedoms of the other side. So you
right.
could have said anything. You could have said Donald Duck, and he would have said, oh, you're just appealing to emotions. You know, so that's also just something
I think one of the things that you're saying here, Joe, is something similar. A friend of mine was saying this yesterday, that the way the laws exist in this country right now, it seems to be, for all the people living under the law, a zero-sum game of a certain kind. And I think in reaction to that, there are some people with respect to immigration policy that they want to think of our Constitution and the laws as being, in effect, a zero-sum Constitution. And so... you know, that basically if there's going to be anything done to our benefit, somebody else is going to have to suffer, and the people who are going to have to suffer should be the immigrants or the would-be immigrants, right?
Yeah.
I would say so.
I think.
Right. And that's the premise that I'm trying to get people to question. That's all. That's the premise I'm trying to get people to question. Is life really a zero-sum game at this moment? Right.
That's a big misnomer in our society. There's a lot of movies and other styles of media that have done us the huge disservice of painting that picture for us. And there are many instances that in that belief, just hurting people's progress, that the economy is a zero-sum game, or that making profit is a zero-sum game. You make profit, other people lose, or all these things that, you know, you can hear Yaron Brook talk about, which I do all the time, listen to him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this person or a group of people like this deserve, they may not have the time or be able to have the attention span to hear the fact that the whole notion of zero sum doesn't really exist. So it's really unfortunate when people believe that, because they believe there can be a conversation where one person has to be a loser.
Right, but to play devil's advocate a little bit on their behalf is that our government is setting certain things up so that it is moving in the direction of making life a zero-sum game, right? So if the government is initiating force against certain citizens on behalf of others, then it behooves everyone to try to say, okay, now I want the government to put my group first and put everybody else in the back of the line to, you know, collect the collective sacrifices, is the way I've put it. You know, whenever government does anything that is not constrained by the principle of rights, whenever it does that, it's putting some segment of the population at the head of the line to collect sacrifices, in effect. Because if the government's initiating force, if it's redistributing wealth, or if it's keeping, you know, would-be peaceful immigrants out, it is forcing some to sacrifice for the so-called interests of other people. And it's a really sad state. So we really do have policies that are doing this. And then the question is, do we therefore drop all reference to principle and decide that we're just going to go ahead and use the system to serve our so-called interests? And that's the thing. Joe, yeah. I thank you for your call. I do have to take a break right now. But I thank you for calling in. I thank you for listening. And hopefully we'll talk again.
Sure, no problem. All right, I'll continue to listen. Have a great show. Thanks.
Great, thanks. Thanks very much. Okay, guys, I'm going to go ahead and just take one of these quick little music breaks, and I'll be right back. Okay, I am back, everyone. Thanks for Joe for calling, and that's cool to have a new first-time caller. So we're talking about this issue of who is appealing to emotion in this debate, and as I said, if you want a background on my position on immigration more generally, I've got a link in the program notes at the blog at don'tletitgo.com, and you can see, you know, through my discussion with Yaron Brook where I sit on the issue. I sit kind of somewhere in between where, you know, there are a number of people who say that they follow Ayn Rand's philosophy and are for very, you know, restrictive immigration policies. And then at the same time, I'm not a so-called open immigration person. I do believe that you should stop people at the borders, that you should screen them. And I think that there is a way to explain that consistent with principles of government and rights. And I attempted to do that in the last segment, but, you know, as I said, you can also go ahead and listen to that show. I explained why I don't believe I am appealing to emotion when I am referencing this principle of individual rights. And then the question is my interlocutor, are the people who are on the other side of the immigration debate, are they appealing to emotions in a certain way? Now, in one way, you would say, okay, well, they're really not appealing to emotions per se, because what was he appealing to? He was appealing to law. Well, you know, law is law. There's certain procedures and there's this rule of law. And so therefore, you know, everybody should follow the law. And if they don't follow the law, then they're therefore bad and everything else. One thing that's an interesting exercise when you study philosophy of law is to try to figure out, where does the moral duty to obey the law come from? Can you have a moral duty to obey the law apart from any reference to what the content of the law is? And in other words, there are these people in law called positivists, and they just define law based on the pedigree of the law. What was the procedure used to pass the law? If it was passed in certain ways, then we just call it law and try to say that it's good for people to obey the law. But if you actually think about it and you really kind of analyze all the different arguments that you could put forth for having some sort of a duty to obey the law, you don't have it. There is no actual just duty. There's got to be some sort of content to it. You have to say, okay, that the thing that the person is doing is also a just thing. And so when I look at these, you know, would-be productive immigrants, and they come here, typically they overstay their visas. And by the way, I saw this out on Twitter, but I didn't go back and search for it. But apparently, overstaying your visa is just some sort of a misdemeanor. It's not even a serious legal violation. But this is how most of the people are here. They're overstaying their visas and then they're working, and a lot of them are taxpayers and everything else. They are not violating anyone's rights. Now, if they are, right, if there's some horrible criminals and stuff, yeah, I'm sympathetic with deporting them or doing whatever else is appropriate. We're not talking about those people. We're talking about people who just want to come here and work and live like everybody else, who aren't posing any sort of imminent threat. Yeah, maybe they don't vote the way you like, but you cannot, and this is a tweet that the Ayn Rand bot put out in the last couple of days as a coincidence, you know, you cannot through government policy create universal rationality in people, right? You cannot force minds. And this is including immigration policy. You know, the idea that you're somehow going to make the entire country rational and you're going to save us politically by keeping out those who want to come here and work and pursue the American dream. It's just crazy. Robert in the chat room is talking about immigration policy. Yeah, he says, you can't say let in all these people unless you have a way to implement those restrictions. Eliminate the quotas, he says, and 98% of the restrictions. Let everyone in except specific right violators, but keep those violators out. Yeah, we need to do that. Josh in the chat room says that Yaron said that he would say, go ahead and shoot people at the border if they try to illegally cross once we have a rational immigration policy implemented. Yes, if we have a rational immigration policy, then yeah. Now, if you say, okay, there's this humanitarian crisis and, you know, it's literally a lifeboat scenario and these people are running across the border for their lives or something, okay, then no, don't shoot them in that particular thing. But we have to distinguish, are we in a situation right now where we're all in a lifeboat where peaceful coexistence is not possible? And this is where I actually think that behind the so-called positivist veneer, behind the appeal to law, the rule of law, behind the appeal to the rule of law of a lot of the Trump supporters is this sense that the world is this dog-eat-dog world, you know, that life is a zero-sum game, that we are in this state of emergency, and that, you know, they're in favor of an immigration policy that's going to do this. The problem is that they don't say, okay, well, it's temporary that I advocate for this and it's because of this thing. The people that I've heard and within the objectivist movement and everything as well, advocating for a more restrictive policy, they think it should be more restrictive all the time. And in fact, they've made analogies to, spoiler alert, Atlas Shrugged. There's a thing called Galt's Gulch that, you know, oh, well, you know, they were able to make certain rules, so we should be able to as well, as a standing immigration policy. And I say no. You know, there's always going to be in the state of the world the threat of war, the threat of disease, the threat of criminals. And we need to set up a rational immigration policy that routinely checks for threats coming in from all of those things at our borders. I think that we're entitled to do that, but the restrictions have to be limited to that. You can't do it based on the guy believes things I don't like or something. You know, you have to tie it to potential rights violations. But I do think that what's going on the other side is an appeal to fear. When I stopped engaging this person, he started misrepresenting my views to try to tug me back into the discussion. People do that as a technique all the time. You tell them, look, I've been around with you in this discussion 5 times. We're going to have to just stop this and agree to disagree about it. I'm done. They'll try to suck you back in by putting stuff out there that just blatantly misrepresents your views. And of course, you're entitled just to say, sorry, I'm not going to continue that discussion. But they're always appealing to, oh, the horrible things that have happened because of immigrants, this, that, or the other, as if the world is going to end if we have a rational immigration policy. And first of all, I don't believe it. If you go, for example, to the New York Times piece that I put in the top of the program notes today, theirs is called Donald Trump's Cowardice on Dreamers. In there, they talk about the fact that these DACA recipients, in contrast to what the Trump supporters are putting out there on Twitter and everywhere else, the DACA recipients are not threats to public safety or national security. To the contrary, write the editors at the New York Times, they must have a nearly spotless record to be eligible in the first place. They do not receive legal status in this country, only a 2-year renewable deferral of deportation along with a work permit and eligibility for other government benefits down the road. They say, and they are not taking the jobs from native-born Americans whose declining levels of employment can be chalked up to other factors. And in fact, I have talked on this show before about the fact, you know, that immigrants don't have the effect of reducing the salaries or anything else. So a lot of that is a myth as well. As for the policy's legality, right, they always say, oh, well, it's illegal. The New York Times op-ed writers say, look, there's no question that the president has the authority to set immigration enforcement priorities. Presidents of both parties have done that for decades, and Obama did it by focusing on people with criminal records and not on those brought to this country as children. So yeah, there are limited law enforcement resources, and Obama is directing them in a certain way. But, you know, I would say, first of all, if you're going to appeal to law as law, that everybody just has a duty to obey the law, regardless of the moral content of the law, I would say that you're the one who's appealing to emotion. And why is it? It's because unless you're looking at the content of the law, I don't see any basis for a moral duty to obey that law. If you disagree with me, if you think you've got a moral basis as to why, there's a great essay in philosophy of law that I'm going to have to actually bring up, but I'm trying to think of the name of the author. It'll come to me at a certain point. And actually what I'll do is I'll go ahead and I'll put it in the program notes. But what this guy does is he goes through all of the possible arguments that you might have for a moral duty to obey the law, even what they call a prima facie duty to obey the law. So you say, okay, other things being equal, you don't know that the law is unjust or anything else. Do you have any sort of a knee-jerk duty to obey the law at all just because it's law? And he shot down argument after argument after argument and saying, look, there is no actual moral duty. If you think about it, if I tell you right now, if I say, look, I broke a law today. I just tell you that I broke a law. Now, some people say we break 9 felonies a day or whatever. But if I say I broke a law today, what do you think of me? Do you have some sort of moral evaluation? And most of us would say no, that I would have to tell you what law it is that I broke before you would even have a moral evaluation of me about the fact that I broke the law. There's a lot of law breaking that people do that has absolutely no negative effect on the fellow human being. And it's the negative effect on the fellow human being, particularly a rights violation, that that is pertinent there. Josh in the chat room is saying that this is actually an appeal to authority. Are they making an appeal to authority? Certainly, I think that they are. They're making an appeal to the procedure and the authority of law as well. So I would argue that they're appealing to the emotion, that emotion is the only thing that can uphold a moral duty to obey the law apart from the content of the law itself. And what I was talking about is the content of our immigration law. I say it's unjust. It's not based on the principle of individual rights. And no, I don't believe I'm appealing to emotion and making assertions about rights. I don't think rights are self-evident the way that our founders did, but I do think it's based on philosophy. And as I said, if you want to know more about the moral foundation of rights, I highly recommend reading Rand's essay called The Objectivist Ethics. Just Google that, The Objectivist Ethics, and you'll be able to find a free copy of that essay. And it goes into quite some detail because it's a pretty complex argument to get from the most rudimentary observation about value pursuit in the world. You know, what things in the world pursue values, you know, plants getting water and, you know, trying to kind of turn their leaves towards the sunlight and all that stuff. plants versus, you know, versus rocks. Rocks don't pursue values. To go from that all the way up to the idea of rights for human beings is a long and detailed argument, but it's there. There's an argument based on reason telling you why these rights must be respected, and they're just not. So here's a question. What is it that Trump is doing with respect to DACA? And I talked about the fact that it's been a little bit of a bait and switch that he's done. And Ben Shapiro remarked on it yesterday. It was kind of funny because on the one hand, he puts that tweet out announcing that they're ending DACA, you know, effective 6 months from now. But Sessions got to go out and announce it. New York Times, of course, was complaining about that. Sessions is no friend of immigration. He's anti-immigration. And so he's the one that gets to go out and announce the demise of DACA. But then the thing that Trump did is then he comes back with another tweet expressing, in effect, a hope that Congress is going to legalize DACA, that the Congress is going to, quote, follow the proper procedure and make DACA suddenly legal. And I tweeted out this morning, well, it's our president's attempt to eat his cake and have it too. And I think people didn't quite understand what I meant, but Shapiro was laughing yesterday because you know, on the one hand, there's the first tweet going, okay, well, DACA's ending in 6 months and all the Trump supporters are cheering. And then Trump comes back and says, well, I hope that Congress can finally pass it. Apparently Congress has not been able to, you know, get any significant immigration reform, which would include something like DACA in it, for 16 years or something. It doesn't matter which president you have, you know, there's different, apparently it's still on the table in one of either the House or the Senate. I can't remember where it is, but it's floating around there and they've never been able to get this done. So in what way am I saying that Trump is attempting to eat his cake and have it too, trying to get both A and non-A? On the one hand, he got his base all excited because, look, he's kept it to campaign promise. He's ending DACA, right? Now, either way that it goes, whether Congress is able to put DACA into legislation and therefore make it procedurally okay or not, Trump has plausible deniability with all of those people in his base. He's in effect punted it over to them, and he looks good either way, right? You know, so somehow it's the legislative process that he's taking as the given, as the thing that he's not going to be able to do anything about. All he's doing is taking this so-called unconstitutional order and he's ending it. And he's saying that we have to accept as the given whatever is going to come out of this legislature. And if it turns out that they go ahead and they put DACA into law, I think he, you know, in terms of heartstrings, he's perfectly happy with that. I think he realizes that the people that would be kicked out if DACA wasn't in place are innocent people, not rights violators, productive, adding to our economy, that we don't have a basis for kicking these people out of our country. I think he knows that. But nonetheless, he wants Congress to either take the blame if they do or don't. Either way. So he can talk to whoever. He can talk to the people who wanted DACA ended, and he can say, well, they passed it. And yeah, I mean, I signed in the law. It's a proper law, you know, and there were these other things in it that you, my supporters, want. Like maybe he's going to try to get border wall stuff, or who knows what he's going to try to get in this legislation. So he wants to have an excuse if it does become law. And then he also wants to have an excuse if it never is able to be in law. And, you know, his base is happy and there's some people who suffer, but it's not his fault. He's got deniability. Why? Because it's just this legislative process. It's this thing that exists. It's apart from him. And what I would say there is he's confusing the metaphysical versus the man-made there, in the sense of, okay, let's leave it to them. You know, he's saying that he wants them to do it, right? But he's also said that he wants them to give him a clean repeal Obamacare bill. And I don't think he wants a clean repeal Obamacare bill. I don't think he wants a clean bill that's going to just end DACA. I'm not even sure that he would sign a clean bill that's going to end DACA, because then his base is going to abandon him. He wants some sort of a bill that will keep DACA, will also have some other goodies to satisfy his base in it and everything else. And he wants to be able to say, oh, I had no choice. It's the legislative process. You know, so he wants to have it both ways. He wants to have, you know, the satisfaction of supposedly keeping a campaign promise, and at the same time, potentially getting this into law, because in reality, I think he knows he would be behaving in an unjust way to the people who might be deported as a result of this. Let me see what else I've got on this discussion of immigration, which has gone on quite a long time. This confusion of the metaphysical versus the man-made, this idea that whatever is in the law, you know, this rule of law idea, that we have to uphold the rule of law, that anybody who breaks the law, no matter what it is a bad person. I think these people are engaged in this sort of confusion that Rand talk about, this discussion of the confusion between the metaphysical and the man-made. Let me see if I can. There was a passage that I wanted to read to you guys as well about this. The metaphysically given cannot be true or false. So the nature of reality, you can't say, you know, it's true or false. It simply is. And man determines the truth or falsehood of his judgments by whether they correspond to or contradict the facts of reality. The metaphysically given cannot be right or wrong. It is the standard of right or wrong by which a rational man judges his goals, his values, his choices. The metaphysically given is, was, will be, and had to be. By contrast, she says, nothing by man had to be. It was made by choice. And if you're trying to rebel against the metaphysically given, then you're engaging in a failed attempt to negate existence. But what are these people doing? What I think that these people are doing is they are erecting the actions of their fellow man, particularly legislators and stuff, as tantamount to something that we have to accept without evaluation at all. I think they're making that other mistake on the other side there. And in fact, what we do need to do when it's human beings who are responsible for law and everything else is judge it. The way I like to talk about it with respect to the rule of law is, yes, the rule of law, adhering to the rule of law is a value, but only if the law we're adhering to is based on the principle of individual rights. The rule of law is not in and of itself really a value apart from law based on rights. You could say, okay, well, it's nice to have the rule of law in a totalitarian dictatorship, so you at least know when, you know, you're violating Big Brother's edicts or something. That was one of the big things in 1984, is that you never really knew exactly when you were violating the law. You just knew you were being watched all the time, and you kind of had the sense of how you're supposed to behave and what you're supposed to believe, but there's no particular law on the books. That's the worst thing. So you could say, okay, well, the rule of law is a value, I guess, in a certain way, apart from the content. But really, the ideal of the rule of law is something that is tied to a proper nature of law, rights as well. But I think what a lot of these Trump supporters are doing is they say, well, I don't really want to have this messy debate about immigration. What I would like to do is just say, let's enforce the law the way it is. I happen to like the law the way it is. Let's just go ahead and enforce it and take it as a given. And there's all these people who have broken the law, these illegal immigrants, and oh boy, aren't they so bad. And my position is no, they're not bad, unless you can say that they've actually violated a right. Now, there's something else that I wanted to talk about with respect to this, and I promised it. I teased it on Facebook for this show. Let me tell you a little bit about how I think Trump is making this mistake of the metaphysical versus the man-made in a different realm entirely. and it's with respect to all these hurricanes. And I put in the program notes at the blog one of his tweets. This Irma is hitting land, and it's probably causing horrible damage. And I wish the best to anybody who might be affected by the hurricane. It's been a really horrible hurricane season in the sense of, you know, I don't morally judge the hurricane itself. The hurricane just is. But in terms of the cost to human life, so all best wishes to people out there. The thing that has struck me about Trump is that he almost seems to be taking some sort of credit about the hurricanes, like, well, you know, and then here's the tweet. He says, "Hurricane looks like largest ever recorded in the Atlantic!" Exclamation point. Like he's excited about it or something. There's some sort of, you know, people talk about in objectivist lore, the, you know, kind of Mother Teresa, that this sort of that suffering creates an opportunity of a certain way. There's a little bit of excitement to Trump. He just seems a little too excited to me about this hurricane that could do a whole lot of damage and everything else. And it's as if the fact that the largest ever recorded in Atlantic hurricane happened on his watch, that somehow that says something positive about him. That's the sense that I'm getting here. And it's like he is in a certain way, I think, confusing the metaphysical versus the man-made in that sense, that there's an evaluation that you're supposed to have of him based on these hurricanes that happen while he happens to be president, which is just ridiculous. But let me tell you this other thing. So Andy Warhol, right? Andy Warhol, the only reason that I know hardly anything about Andy Warhol is because of Duran Duran. I was a huge Duran Duran fan, and heaven forbid, I mean, what I did is I actually read books that these musicians said were like their favorite books. And the weird keyboardist from Duran Duran, Nick Rhodes, said that there was this book by Andy Warhol that's like one of his favorite books, The Philosophy of Andy Warhol from A to B and Back Again. So I read this book years ago, and I remember almost nothing of this book. There's only one thing that I remember from this book, and it's this. Andy Warhol talks in the book about he dyed his hair gray at a certain age, like I think 35 or something. He just dyed his hair gray. Now, these days, right now, it's a fashion to dye your hair gray, but it has nothing to do with why Andy Warhol said he did it. So here's Andy Warhol. He's explaining in his book why he dyed his hair gray. And he said he did it because, on the one hand, if he did something that made him appear senile, then he'd get away with it because they'd say, oh, well, you know, he's old, he's got this gray hair, you know, right? And then if he did something that seemed sort of young and sprightly and you know, vivacious and everything else, then they'd say, oh, wow, you know, he's so young and lively and vivacious for his age. Isn't that wonderful? So either way, he'd win if he dyed his hair gray, right? He'd get off easy if he did something that seemed kind of stupid or senile or old. And if he did some good stuff, then they'd say, oh, wow, he's acting so young for his age. Isn't that wonderful? And everything would be peachy keen. This is why he said he dyed his hair gray. Now, here's Trump, right? So here's this big hurricane. Now, if Trump does this really good job and everything works out, right? You know, he's got the largest ever recorded in the Atlantic. If he does a really good job helping the disaster relief effort for the hurricane, he takes credit. If, on the other hand, disaster relief efforts don't look so good, you know, he goes out there and talks them up, but then when the New York Times comes in and digs and sees what really happens, it's really a mess and a fiasco, and he really hasn't handled the disaster so well. Well, look, it was the largest ever recorded in the Atlantic. You can't blame him. The same exact issue, right? So in a way, I feel like he's emphasizing how horrible these are, so that no matter what happens afterwards and when they come back and they look, you know, through the fine microscope to see how he did, he's going to get credit if he kicks some butt with it, and he's going to get a lot of credit because it's the largest ever recorded in the Atlantic. And then if it doesn't go so well, then he can't be blamed, right? And he's doing exactly the same thing with respect to DACA, right? No matter what happens with DACA, now he's just put it in the hands of the legislator. He's, you know, you can just blame it. He's got plausible deniability because all he's doing is saying, look, DACA was just unconstitutional. It was an unconstitutional executive order. So I'm just waiting for something that's constitutional to do the right thing. And whichever way it comes down with DACA, whether they end up legalizing part of it through legislatures, you know, the legislative process or not, he's got this plausible deniability, just like Andy Warhol had plausible deniability with respect to the gray hair. Trump is putting himself in these situations. Why? Because he doesn't want to actually apply a principle and make a real judgment. I've talked about this on past shows. What is he about? He is a pragmatist, and pragmatists are fundamentally about satisfying demand. If you go back, if you listen to that inauguration address, he is talking about satisfying the demands of various sectors of society. What was he tweeting about the other day, right? He's talking about he's finally going to put Americans first, or hardworking Americans first. That's what he says he's going to do. Satisfy the demands of hardworking Americans, as opposed to whom? American employers, would-be peaceful immigrants. You know, he's going to satisfy certain demands over here, certain demands over there. When there are things where he knows that he might be blamed based on what's going to happen in the future, like with DACA, he's going to be blamed either way, no matter what happens, by somebody. Somebody is going to blame him, and it could really hurt him. On the one hand, he's going to get blamed. Silicon Valley is chiming in against him. A lot of people are chiming in against him. Why? Because it is unjust to end DACA without any sort of immigration reform. So people know this. He's going to be held accountable for it, but he's going to say, oh no, it's just the legislative process. It's not my fault. On the other hand, if something comes through the legislative process, then he's got plausible deniability. Well, is this the only bill that I could get on my desk and I've got to sign it because look, it's got these other good things in it. No matter what happens in the future, he has set it up so it's like the gray hair. He's covered, just like Andy Warhol was covered. No matter what he did in the future, he could either take credit or deflect blame, no matter what happened in the future. Yeah, just Jean's in the chat room says, yeah, ha, either way, Trump is blameless. Yeah, but this is, you know, again, I'm walking around doing my little pictures of flowers and stuff this morning. It's exactly the analogy that came to mind. And it follows with the hurricane. It follows with the DACA. In these situations where he knows, in effect, that the demands being made of him are roughly balanced, or maybe even he knows that what the right thing to do would be contradicts his campaign promises. Right? What's the right thing to do with DACA? It contradicts his promise, which is to satisfy his base and keep all those evil, scary immigrants out of our country. When he knows that is happening, he wants to put himself in the situation like Andy Warhol, dyeing his hair gray. So yeah, that was the value. That was my whole value for having read that book, is that I could give you that analogy today. Why don't I go ahead and I'm going to play again, we're going to take a little musical interlude, and we're going to come back and we'll clean up with other stories that I've got in the program notes. Go to the program notes over at don'tletitgo.com if you want to see what I'm going to talk about after the break. Okay, everyone, we are back, and thanks to everyone over in the Blog Talk Radio chat room for hanging out with me. If you do want to call in and talk to me during this last segment of the show, the number is 760-888-5817. Poor helpless narcissist, says Craig in the chat room. But it's just very clever the way he sets these things up, right, so that he can be blameless no matter what. It's so awesome. By the way, one of the things I'm doing, I don't know if you guys are on Twitter, but each day, if I can think of anything that's substantive to do so, I am tweeting to our president. I call it tweet to our dear leader, and it's in the spirit of defiance, right? Defiance is the way that Americans deal with overbearing authority, and we certainly have that right now. We have a president acting, in essence, on pragmatist whim. So you can follow on Twitter and follow along with my attempt to do that. Some days he practices what I call safe tweeting. He either retweets other people or he tweets about something that's really not very controversial and you can't really dig in. I'm not going to force it, but if I can think of something every day, I'm going to go ahead and do it. So, other stories. New York Times published this opinion piece the other day, and it looks so promising based on the headline. The headline is, Why We Should Put Women on Pedestals. I'm a woman. Being on a pedestal kind of sounds cool. And in fact, I saw this beautiful sculpture in Copenhagen where there was a woman on a pedestal being adored by the man that she loves. Adoratio, I believe is the name. Adoration. And just a gorgeous piece. So this is what came to my mind. But no, of course, this could not be about that. Instead, it had to be about, in effect, what is affirmative action for sculpture and monuments on display out there in the public space. So what the article ends up talking about is the ratio of sculptures or monuments that feature women versus men. And of course, if you talk about women as a percentage of the population versus women subjects as a percentage of the subject matter of monuments and sculptures and stuff, the amount of sculptures is far less. United States, says this opinion piece. Again, who's the author of this opinion piece? Let me go back. Julia Baird is the author. She said, in the United States, then there are, I guess, less than 8% of public statues are female. 9 of 411 national parks are dedicated to women's history, which is why women have been stealthily gathering funds to break through the, quote, bronze ceiling and place statues of women in busy public spaces. There's a campaign that began in February called Put Her on the Map. It aims to, quote, encourage cities and corporations to put women on the map by naming streets, statues, and buildings after influential female figures. And I'd say, okay, if we want to have more stamps, streets, statues dedicated to Rand, Margaret Thatcher, other heroic female figures, I'm all for that. But I bet that that's not what these people are for. Now, a suffragist, sure, I'm up for a suffragist. That would be nice. But in any event, yeah, it wasn't what I thought it was. It was about affirmative action for statues, New York Times being the New York Times. Another piece over here. K. McKinnon says, don't be a statue. Somebody will want to tear you down. In fact, you know, there is a bust of Ayn Rand at Chapman University, which is in Southern California. And I saw an article online that the statue or the bust had been vandalized by students there because, of course, students don't even really know what Rand is about, probably. And anybody who disagrees with their leftist ideas, they figure they are entitled to go ahead and just vandalize the statue, and that's what they did. Another potpourri of articles here. I saw this on Fox News today. Buyer beware, courts could raise the cost of online shopping. And this is another area in which, you know, Trump has spoken out and basically is promoting certain policies that meet the demands of certain interest groups in the country. But in effect, all he's doing is he's putting some people first in line to collect the sacrifices from somebody else. This is the way that I'm always going to keep talking about this, is that insofar as Trump is not acting on principle, he's not acting on the principle of individual rights, all he's doing is he is kind of rearranging the order that we all are in the line to collect sacrifices from everybody else. And so what do they want to do now? They want to make you, when you buy something online through Amazon, pay sales tax, right? Because all of these state governments. They're very upset that they're missing out on sales tax revenue because you are opting for the convenience of Amazon. Then, of course, also, if you buy through Amazon and it's a third-party seller, I believe you can get that item tax-free so long as that third-party seller doesn't have a physical footprint in the state where you're living. So if I buy something from a third-party seller and that third-party seller is in Maryland and doesn't have any physical footprint in California, then fine, you know, I can get that tax-free. No longer if these people get their way. And in fact, Trump has been out there tweeting, saying that Amazon is, quote, doing damage. This is from Trump. He said, quote, Amazon is doing great damage to tax-paying retailers. Towns, cities, and states throughout the U.S. are being hurt. Many jobs being lost, exclamation point. Love his exclamation points. He's the one who's appealing to suffering and emotion, right? He's appealing to that there because he's certainly not appealing to a principle. He's talking about people having been done damage as if there's been some physical harm initiated against them, but it's not. People are simply engaging in voluntary transactions, choosing not to be gouged with sales tax. And in fact, if I go shopping on Amazon, it's not like I say, oh, I'm going to buy this one versus that one because of the sales tax. I don't get that fine-grained about it. I'm happy to not have to pay as much sales tax overall when I, you know, do shopping on Amazon, but you know, which item does and which item doesn't. It's not like I'm trying, but if there are people who do that, they say, look, I don't want to pay sales tax, especially on a more expensive item. You'll shop in a way that helps you avoid that sales tax. You're just keeping more of your own money. And then here's Trump. He's portraying it, you know, you're doing damage. I wonder if his supporters ever think about this, that if when, not maybe, it's probably when, right? Because I think the writing's on the wall that they're going to try, you know, to force tax collection for all of the sales on Amazon and everywhere else. When this happens, will Trump supporters realize that they're actually being hurt in the pocketbook? Probably not. That's what I figure. Yeah, just Jean in the chat room says, what's the solution? The solution is to eliminate the sales tax on the local retailers, of course. But nobody wants that because sales tax is a way that we play, you know, we pay for our bloated local governments that do a whole lot of things that government shouldn't even be doing. What's actually going on with respect to making this into some kind of law? There's litigation that includes the state of South Carolina. South Carolina recently sued Amazon over what it claims is a $12.5 million loss in sales tax revenue from third-party sellers. Three other online sellers sued South Dakota over its tax laws, and then two trade groups have sued Tennessee. So they're trying to hash this all out in court and say that somehow Amazon is the cause of them unjustly losing the sales tax revenues. Some of the sellers where, you know, the laws have been, you know, they're saying you have to collect it and you haven't, they're actually suing the states. So some way or another, this is going to end up being resolved. And given Trump's sympathy for the tax collectors and against Amazon, I'm kind of scared about what's going to happen. And this is the sort of thing that makes you think that life is a zero-sum game. Trump supporters, how do you defend this from him? That he wants you to have to pay more taxes, that you can no longer buy things tax-free from Amazon. I know a number of people who have called themselves Trump supporters. As far as I know, they should be pretty outraged at having to pay more tax through their Amazon transactions. An interesting piece, an opinion piece over at the Washington Post, Steve Jobs gave us President Trump. And what it talks about is that before this election season, the political parties seem to exert their traditional influence. In the piece, it says this: the power of traditional party leaders flows from their ability to make and control connections that are otherwise difficult. Skipping down, they say, through different linkages, the party mediates the most important connection of all between the candidate and the voters. So if you were a candidate for political office before just about this last election cycle or so, you could not make a direct connection with the voters. The voters wouldn't know on the ballot who you were and what you stood for unless the party had mediated in some way in your favor and allowed your ideas to be exposed to the voters. Now, the piece here says, thanks to Steve Jobs, making our smartphones and everything, we all have direct access to our candidates. Now, a lot of us make jokes about it and stuff. As I've talked about in the past, I think there are good things, something very American about having direct access to Donald Trump on Twitter. The fact that I can tweet to him and make fun of him and criticize him and joke about him and call it Tweet to Our Dear Leader and everything. It's very American to be able to do this on the exact same platform. He's tweeting, I'm tweeting, we're all tweeting. And what they're saying is that it's reducing the influence of the party. And it's not just on the Republican side. You know, one criticism of the headline is it's not that it gave us Donald Trump. It made somebody like Trump who could bypass the party possible. It just happened to be that the person who bypassed the party is somebody who has absolutely no principle at all and is sort of a loose cannon that we worry about. Did it have to be that way? No, because this is a revolution like the printing press, which is discussed in this opinion piece over at the Post. The printing press created this revolution such that everybody could read the Bible for themselves and they didn't have to experience religion intermediated by the anointed clergy, right? And similarly now, people, and they, you know, it's so funny because they talk about Mitch McConnell in this way. It's like, you know, Mitch McConnell's kind of like this anointed cloistered clergyman type person, and McConnell has no power. McConnell's not going to be able to get anything done unless he's doing something along the lines of Trump's base, the people that Trump is motivating and energizing through mechanisms like Twitter. So yeah, this is a revolution. It almost gave us a Bernie Sanders on the other side. So it's not like, oh, you know, it inexorably gave us Trump per se, but it made somebody like Trump possible because it makes it possible to bypass the party mechanism, the party bureaucracy, the party machine, and talk straight to the voters, which I think is a wonderful thing. So there's that. And then what else did I have there in the notes? There was this interesting piece that a Twitter follower sent, and it was talking about the political makeup of Silicon Valley. And I don't know if you call this good news or bad news. It's got some potentially good news element to it, which is this. Silicon Valley is liberal with one big exception. And he's saying that the big exception is government regulation. Silicon Valley leaders, they do not want government telling it how it can do its job. And in particular, the thing that was cited in the piece that's discussed is whether they want to be told who they can fire, right? One of the things in Silicon Valley is if you have a low performing employee, you want to just be able to drop that person and fire them. And employment law in particular has so many hoops that you have to jump through before you can ever fire a low performing employee that, you know, there's no way you can do it. So do we think that, well, this is good because regulation is super important and it's the one issue that they're more conservative about? I actually think it's got a lot better news than that, because really, if you read the piece, the only area in which they're very liberal is on the issue of redistribution of wealth. And, you know, could we get to them and say, in effect, redistribution of wealth is another way that government is telling you how you can live your life? It's tantamount to regulation. I think that there's some kind of persuasive opportunity there as well. You guys, I'm at the end of the hour here, or the end of my time. I will talk to you on Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, 12 p.m. Pacific. I look forward to it. I hope you will join me again. Take care.